Ridiculous History is a production of iHeartRadio. Welcome to the show, Ridiculous Historians. Thank you so much for tuning in. My name is Ben, and as usual, I am starving.
My name is Nolan. Ben, I have one question for you.
Shoot.
Are you down with MRE?
You know me.
Yeah. I do know you. You're Ben. You already said that, though.
Yeah, and you're Noel.
I said that as well.
Okay, so we're all caught up. We know each other.
We are ourselves. We know each other.
And we also know our super producer, Casey Pegram.
That's true, but we have an unknown quantity in the room in spirit sort of today, don't
what?
We, Ben? Yeah, it's true.
That's true, though. We are not diving into today's episode on our Trio Lonesome.
Sure.
Yeah. We are joined today by a friend of ours, a peer podcaster of ours, Jacqueline Raposo, the host of one of the most exciting podcasts we've had come out recently, which is Service, Veteran Stories of Hunger and War. Now, Jacqueline is a freelance food writer, and when you and I were talking about how we could team up and collaborate, we thought, who better to help us explore today's episode than a real-life expert? So, Jacqueline, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, I am so glad to be here. I'm very enthusiastic about this MRE topic, so I'm excited to nerd out about it for a bit.
Well, I will, a little peek behind the curtain, Ben has long been an MRE enthusiast himself.
Uh-oh.
It's a bit of a collection, if I'm not mistaken. And I think you acquired a couple of new ones recently that you were a little bummed about because they were of the breakfast variety.
Oh, yeah, that's correct. You can't win them all.
No?
I got a deal on some MREs.
Well, like at the Army Surplus Store, or where do you even?
I got them online, and they were random pulls.
Okay.
And I actually have one for you that I've got to give you.
What?
Yeah.
Oh,
and,
man. I'm honored.
And, you know, there are several different menus, as you know, Jacqueline, and you can get a deal where you'll say, okay, I'll get a low price on like three or four of these, but you don't get to choose the menu.
Don't get to pick. You get what you get. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Are you just anti-breakfast or just anti-MRE breakfast?
I'm skeptical of eggs that don't need refrigeration.
Ooh, that is a good point.
You know what I mean?
Well, we'll get into more of that and the whole idea of food preservation and, you know, making things last longer than they should than the normal shelf life. But to start off, obviously today we are talking about MREs, which stands for Meals Ready to Eat.
Yep.
Why do they leave the tea out?
Because
tea is implied?
Yeah, yeah. And also, it just sounds better, MRE.
Yeah,
but they went through a couple different lines. And, you know, Jacqueline, when you set off to create the podcast Service, it feels like you tapped into this rich, fertile soil of stories that are unfamiliar to a lot of people. And just speaking for myself, a lot of these stories were unfamiliar to me before we started preparing for this episode. Could you tell us a little bit about what inspired you to create this podcast?
Yeah, well, actually, directly this breakfast MRE issue was sort of it. I was dating a guy who did two tours in Iraq as an army captain, and he started telling me stories about doctoring his MREs up, especially the instant coffee, the powdered eggs, the powdered milk products they had, the breakfast ones. I'm excited to hear what you got in your breakfast MREs. I've never seen those. But talking about how horrible they are to eat out in the field when you're hungry and you're tired. And he started talking about mixing them up and trying to make them taste better. And I told the story to my grandfather, who was in the Army in World War II, and he sort of started laughing and nodding his head and saying how, oh, yeah, the instant coffee and how horrible it was back then, and started telling me sort of similar stories about how bad their K-rations were. And that made me think about this whole world that I just didn't, as a food writer and as someone who knows, you know, who's every generation of my family has served going back to the Civil War, yet I did not know this stuff. And so I was like, oh, wow, this is a whole element of food history that we have not sort of gotten down. So hearing just that sort of umbrella of how bad the food was and in some ways still is a very sort of exciting thing to get to delve into with every episode.
Yeah. This is funny because we also have a lot of people in our audience who are veterans or they have family members in the military. And so a lot of people, I think it's safe to say, at least here in the U.S., have grown up, maybe seen an MRE as a kid. And, you know, it's a cool thing. It's packaged. It lasts forever. And if you like Noel and I are a fan of kits, then, you know, you open it up and you have so much cool stuff to play with, at least as a kid. You know, when you're out in the field and it's your job, you're just trying to eat something that doesn't taste terrible, right? We delved into the history of Army food because one thing we've got to say to anybody who's thought, I had a terrible MRE, the worst MRE today is still way, way better than what armies ate for the, like, majority of human history, right?
Oh, God, yeah.
Well, because they have such a bad rap. It's insane. Like, I mean, you think about the idea of these, you know, MRE packages, and it's army food in general has always kind of notoriously had this really terrible rap. And like you said, it's made leaps and bounds, you know, by today's standards, they're a whole lot better. But it's often said that, you know, an army, this is a quote in some of the research we found, an army marches on its stomach. And so these things are not only, I mean, obviously, first and foremost, they're about survival. So the idea of flavor and taste, probably, you know, a third, fourth kind of priority there. But the history of MREs in general is a really, really fascinating one. And it kind of goes hand in hand with the history of food preservation and things like canning and like salted meats and all of that. Why don't we start there? Go into a little of the backstory.
Yeah. Well, I think the first thing we have to think about is just how armies are moving across time. So if we think, you know, way back, if we think back to the Sumerians and the ancient Egyptians, you know, if you're battling sort of other tribes that are a couple miles away, then you're just bringing the equivalent of like snacks with you, right? And then you're going home and you're cooking. So thinking of bringing with you starchy things like bread, which way back when would have been something made from barley or rye, not wheat, because we weren't cultivating wheat. Then it became hardtack, which is basically like a cracker version. It's sort of like a hard bread because we're not thinking these like, you know, fluffy yeasted breads that we have today, which would eventually become a problem for the military of how to make, you know, light and fluffy bread that would not get moldy and last. These are like crackers and hard breads. And then one thing that I don't know exactly why this was, but these ancient militaries usually carried onions with them. And I don't know if onions are a thing against scurvy, maybe, because I don't know if they actually like put two and two together with needing vegetables until much later, until we get more towards our revolutionary and civil wars. But
sure,
a lot of them, the Sumerians, the Assyrians, the Egyptians, they usually carried an onion with them. Or it could have been because a lot of times when they did have to go a little bit further, when they were traveling for a couple days at a time, these guys were also cooking for themselves. Sometimes they would be carrying 20-pound bags of grain on their shoulders as well and actually cooking.
There's also nothing more of a badass flex than just taking a giant bite of a raw onion.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I think that might have had something to do with it. That's just conjecture on my part.
But it's like, if they treat themselves that way, what are they going to do to us?
Right.
Run.
Exactly.
Tie an onion to your belt, as was the style at the time.
Indeed.
For the Simpsons fans. Yeah, this is fascinating because I love that you're pointing out the soldiers, especially when we look at empires where they were moving across great distances, they did have to cook and they did have to haul their supplies. Supply chain is something that still bedevils modern militaries today. We found that in the West, at least in ancient Rome, soldiers did have a ration of food that was supplied to them. And one thing that might interest a lot of people is that, as we'll find, militaries would frequently have alcoholic beverages as part of their ration, but it wasn't like a huge, you know, ancient Greco-Roman party time. The wine was often safer than the groundwater, right? So now we have these guys who are carrying like 20-pound sacks of grain And then, you know, their lucky onion and maybe a sack of wine. It's just, it's bizarre.
Well, and like, as far as the wine piece, again, that was part of, that was a functional thing more than just wanting to get sloshed every step of the way. It was a lot easier and more predictable to drink wine than it was the questionable quality of water that you might get, right?
Yeah. And then even back in the days of yore, all military options were not created equally. So, Jacqueline, could you tell us a little bit about how people ate in the Navy, right? That's something that we know was even more of a difficult proposition.
Well, the Navy was sort of like a double-edged sword because in a way in the Navies, you've got some space on ships to be transporting things with you, but then you've got, you know, moisture and humidity issues. You've got things that are rotting and going bad. So you've got, yeah, more room to be transporting, you know, wine, which, you know, is great and all that, and the beer and the rum and that kind of stuff. But then on top of that, you've got problems with grains going bad. You've got a lot of fish. So we're talking about salted fish, cod, and whatever is going to be native to whatever part of the world this Navy is sort of moving within. And then a lot of things going just bad on Navy ships. There's not a lot of space to cook. It's not like our modern Navy where they've got these amazing kitchens, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so again, hard biscuits, salted meat, salted fish, not fresh water to wash it down with. You're going to get a little bit of like the sugar from the wine or the beer to give you a little bit of energy. But, you know, when you talk about your digestive system and marching on your stomach, it's not exactly like this nice, clean energy we think of nowadays when we're talking about working out or going hiking. It's a lot of grumpy men.
Absolutely. And when we're talking about salted fish and salted meat, we're not talking about a nice lox or like a charcuterie tray, right? Like this is pretty kind of rudimentary, not particularly tasty stuff, right?
Yeah. And this is way before we know about, you know, bacteria growing and what that is. So these are also like things hanging in the open air, you know, as they're being moved about. And this is the way it's done for, you know, hundreds of years before we get to the idea of actually even how we move meat and fish from place to place and like cut it off the carcasses and transport it in different ways. So this is literally like carcasses hanging and just drying out, which in some ways can make amazing prosciutto and stuff like that. But in other ways can just be like, you know, things are eating away from the insides of animals and coming to the surface before you're hopefully cooking the bacteria out of them. So a lot of inconsistency and, you know, then put that on men in a ship. So not delicious.
But they were cooking their food, right? I mean, they would have some sort of like olive oil, for example, where they could use that as a cooking implement.
Yeah, that's why a lot of times they're carrying some sort of cured meat product that actually has like fat in it too. So they'd either be carrying lardo or carrying sausages or carrying like cured pork, especially for the ancient Roman Empire. The Romans actually comparatively had like really good pork products because they were, you know, Romans. You have some sort of fat to cook with you. You've got the onion, you've got some sort of grain, you've got a cured meat. So there is a semblance of being able to make something with, you know, whatever liquid you can find and fire. And this is where too, you know, compared to complaining about our MREs today, this is a very, you go and fight and then you got to cook for yourself.
Right.
A lot of the time. It's either pillaging and finding food from the villages you're going into and just taking their food, or stopping on the side of the road and cooking your own food with your rations. And a lot of times the rations were, oh, it's this amount of bread to cook into some, to make a stew with your meat and whatever else you can find. Or, you know, finding vegetables on the side of the road on these farms, or, you know, using the grain that you're given as a ration. They're not snack packs, you know, that you're just eating as you go.
Right. This is way before the culinary revolution of the Lunchable.
Exactly. Yeah.
And that's one of the reasons why civilian populations often hated or feared armies, even friendly armies, because, you know, if you've got an army going through the country to the border, they're still going to have to eat whatever they can find. So even if it's quote unquote your army or you're part of the same empire, it could pose a real threat to your livestock and your crops, right?
Exactly. And that's like that's one of the main reasons why we have all of these just constant land wars in ancient history. You can't sort of take over other people's land with your military if you're not absorbing their resources. And there are some really weird things that I love about different civilizations and how they would do that as they went on. My favorite is actually the Mongols. And they would, this is to me by far the weirdest, they were these fierce riders. And they would, you know, be riding one horse with two trailing behind them. So then they could switch horses and be riding, you know, further than other armies had ridden. And while they're doing that, they're taking meat and curing it like underneath their saddles, like letting like the heat of their bodies and the friction like beat up this meat on their saddles. Or the same thing with milk. They're like taking this like milk and letting it become cheese in their saddlebags as they're going along. So it becomes this sort of like weird. Yeah, I know, right? It's like sounds disgusting to be like curing cheese and pounding meat from the heat of your horse. And then I don't know how true this is. I read enough that makes me think that this was definitely true, that they would also, because they could not just, you know, pull up grass and get nutrients from grass, but that's what horses do. They would now and then just like slice a little vein in their horse and drink some blood to get those nutrients, knowing that it wasn't going to kill the horse.
I heard that too. And that's not too crazy.
I think we're burying the lead here a little bit. You just coined a really incredible catchphrase, pounding meat by the heat of their horse.
Pounding meat by the heat of their horse.
Yeah, that is a very evocative expression there. One thing that came up that in this research that I thought was fascinating that I don't think we've talked about yet is in the Byzantine Empire, they were super resourceful. They had these little like hand kind of mills, I guess.
Oh, yeah.
That like, they would, yeah.
Like, and, like Olive Garden pepper grinder,
exactly,
kind of.
Exactly so. And they would kind of, you know, make their own bread on the go, which seems insane to me. Like, what a commitment that is. Can you talk a little bit about what that process might have been like? Like, how do you get it to rise? Like, how do you do all this? I don't understand.
That's the thing. We're not talking about risen breads at this point. Like, that's why when we say hard tack, it's called hard tack. You know, and which is essentially that's a cracker, but these are not these again are not like the light fluffy breads. They're I'm trying to think of like the equivalent of today, but they're flat breads essentially comparatively. So yeah, you're grinding flour, which because it does have, you know, some of these flours do have a good amount of gluten in them. They are going to sort of develop. You can sort of add salt if they're fermenting them too. Like you can ferment a flour for a while, so some of these flours are going to ferment, and if you stick that on a hot pan, that's going to give a sense of rise to it too. You're going to have enough reaction there that you're going to get a little rise there. But again, we're not thinking about ovens here. We're not thinking about like big camps necessarily where they're having these big stone ovens and they're coming out with these big loaves of bread. Like they would have that in, you know, what we would consider maybe these base camps of these forts and things like that. But that's where other people would be cooking for them with properly ground flours. These are going to be like rudimentary ground, coarsely ground flours.
Almost like a matzah, like an unleavened bread kind of situation.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's different. It's definitely survival bread, not, you know, it's not luxurious comparatively. Yes.
It's sorrowful bread for sure. For hundreds, if not thousands of years, this kind of stuff was more the rule than the exception, until a revolutionary moment in food storage history, which is a weird sentence, you know, out of context. That is the invention of a Parisian chef named Nicolas Appert, A-P-P-E-R-T, all the way in like the late 18th century, so 1790s. He is ultimately, right, the reason that we figured out canning. But that's not exactly what he did, right?
Yeah, he figured out our basic means of why things that are preserved in glass jars, why, like, if we're making at home nowadays, if we're making applesauce or pickles or jam, you know, when we take our mason jars and, you know, take the hot jam that we're making and put it in mason jars and boil it to seal it, that's what he came up with, essentially. And it was in a direct result of Napoleon having 1.5 million men to feed. And he had tried the sort of like pillage thing. We're like, okay, we're going to bring some food with us and then we're going to pillage for it. And found out that that wasn't going to work with 1.5 million men. And so said, okay, we're going to give a prize to whoever can figure this out for us. And a pair being a chocolate maker at the time, he was a chef and then went into candy. And so he was already working with things like using a bain-marie to slowly, you know, cook down candies to melt chocolate, to figure out ratios of sugar in jams and jellies to have them set correctly. He was already working on that kind of stuff. And he really jumped into this contest to figure out how they could preserve foods like they did wine. Like, they already knew that if you took wine and put it in a bottle and corked it, it was going to last for a long time. It wasn't going to explode. It's different than champagne, you know? So he figured there had to be a way to do that with food. And that's sort of what he set out to figure out.
Well, and it's interesting, too, because a lot of this was just sort of trial and error, observational stuff. Like, he didn't understand the science behind it at all.
He was just
sort of like, okay, this works. I've experimented. This is the best method for getting this done. Let's just keep doing it this way. And then it was a good ways later before the actual science of it was figured out, right?
Yeah. What he figured out was essentially taking air out, because air is going to do a bunch of different things to food as it breaks down. It's going to, you know, air oxidizes certain things. It draws sugars out. You've got fat oxidation. It breaks down the cell structure of things. So as food ages, a lot happens, essentially primarily because of air. You've got heat and light and other things. But he found out that, if I just take the air out, and that's why, like, sealing something in a jar and then boiling it to, you know, get as much air out as possible, that was one part of it. And then the other was essentially getting in the boiling process, getting that sort of at a certain point where, okay, this is cooked to the point that we want it to. A lot of the things already had sugar and salt, which we know, again, pull moisture out. So we're getting as much of sort of bacteria accidentally killed. It's already transformed bacteria. He didn't know this, but those things are sort of cooked out to a point. So we're pulling as much water out of the food substance as possible, using sugar or salt to kill bacteria as much as we can, and then eliminating air, which is going to then reduce the food from decomposing more until it's eaten. That's basically what he figured out.
Right, without even knowing the concept of aerobic bacteria. He was fighting, you know, one of the main antagonists in the story of preserving food. I always loved to picture all of the misses that he made along the way. You know what I mean? We don't know too much about all, like, to your point, Noel, about all the things he got wrong along the way. But shout out to him for winning that prize of, I think it was 12,000 gold francs in 1810, and even getting a book deal out of it in his work, The Book for All Households, or The Art of Preserving Animal and Vegetable Substances for Many Years.
Really, really creative title.
Titles were longer back then.
Yeah.
People had more time to read.
Well, I mean, at least, you know, it spells it out for you. You know exactly what you're getting.
Yeah, attention spans, I guess. They had more time for that kind of stuff. That's like a book right there, is that title nowadays. So
right.
Yeah, good on him.
You know, one thing that's very important that you hit on, Jacqueline, is that we can't quite call him, you know, the quote unquote father of canning or anything, because he was working with glass. And it's not until a few years later, Peter Durand in England decides, hey, let's switch from glass to these tin containers, or technically tin-coated iron containers. And soon enough, he's off to the races, and this means that the English Royal Navy, the British Royal Navy, is the first military to have what we would call canned food today, correct?
Yeah, and it's funny, like, we don't think about them at all now, but to think about what a novel invention a tin can is. They'd only had glass up until then. And now you have another container that, the key is that they're cooking food in these containers. It's not that they're taking food, putting it in a jar, and then cooking it. So you're actually cooking the food in the can. And that's sort of the big deal there. Or sometimes you're cooking the food first and then putting it in the can and then cooking it again. But the fact that you can actually cook a food item in its container and seal it and have it then be pretty durable, that it's not going to, I mean, they had problems with this, but it's generally that the hope is that it's not going to explode on you because of breakdowns of things inside, that it's going to be a really durable container. Like, that's pretty huge when that has never existed before.
And we know that from that point, cans became, you know, the hot new thing. There's still a hot new thing, right? Most people have cans of something in their pantry, even if it's just like soup or some black beans, because they keep forever. And the U.S. military figured this out too, right? I think what we would consider the predecessor of the MRE was actually a tin container, right?
Yeah. So the first time they started trying this out for the military, before they even figured the actual ration part, was just trying to ship meat in tin cans, which they did for the Spanish-American War at the end of the 19th century. And they were also generally just trying to find a better way to ship meat in general, because meat is the most expensive part of any menu in a restaurant for the military. It's always meat. And this is before they had even figured out how to break meat down from, like, this is when they were still shipping whole carcass animals on train cars. They had refrigerator train cars by this point, but this was literally like meat dangling, you know, whole animal, and they weren't breaking it down or freezing it. This is just meat going from, you know, Wisconsin or whatever to Florida to then get on boats to go to Cuba or to Puerto Rico or over to Guam or whatever. So they were trying to put meat in cans. And what ended up happening is because they didn't have this food science, just as far as how food breaks down, just like as food breaks down with heat, now you're taking meat in a can and putting it in a very hot climate. And so it didn't work out very well in the Spanish-American War. It just sort of went bad, not in a bad way that it got like what we'd think of as bad bacteria like salmonella or E. coli or anything like that. But in a way that people got sick. They were already having problems with yellow fever and typhoid and things like that. But for American troops, only 385 died in combat and 2,485 died of illness. And so everybody assumed it was the meat, that it was the bad meat. It ended up not being the bad meat. The meat did go bad. It looked, they called it embalmed meat, basically embalmed beef, because it looked gross. It got, you know, it had a film on top and it smelled horrible. Just like, you know, you leave beef in the refrigerator a little bit too long, it's going to look brown and it's going to smell a little tinny, a little minerally, but you can still cook it and then it's fine. Think about that times like, you know, 20, that all of a sudden like the meat is going to look bad and smell bad, but technically it's still safe if you just cook it. This was a lot worse, that it was slimy and smelled horrible and nobody wanted to eat it. And on top of that, these guys are already sick. And it really sort of put the military off before World War I of wanting to use canned meat for a little while. So it was sort of a little hiccup, which they got over, but it wasn't the best way to start.
Yeah. Yeah. We do at least see that there was a move to organize things into kits toward the last half or toward the end of World War I, where they would get a ration that was, let's see, we actually got the numbers here. Jacqueline, for background here on Ridiculous History, one thing that often bedevils us is we'll learn about historic dinners or meals of importance and we can never find the menu. So this is big for us to actually know what these folks were eating. They had 12 ounces of bacon or some kind of meat, 2 8-ounce cans of, again, hardtack. They had some pre-ground coffee, some sugar, a salt pack. Interestingly enough, at the time, they were also given a tobacco ration, which I guess just speaks to how common smoking was at the time. But they went back, Uncle Sam went back and continually tried to improve this. I believe it was in 1936, they got some variation of menus, so you weren't always eating the same thing. And then at the very top of the show, you mentioned something called, I believe, the K ration. It comes after the rise of something called the C ration in 1938. Now, while these are military food, they don't look anything like the MREs of today, right? They're kind of a box.
Yeah. So in World War I, they basically used the can like you would a lunchbox. You know, they put all these dried sort of foods in the can so that they were generally waterproof and you could carry them around, and it just made it easier. Essentially, that's sort of what the K ration was, in World War II, which they had just taken this idea of all of these military foods throughout history. And what were they? They were basically, again, something sort of crackery, something dried. Now we have instant coffee, which came out in World War I, which again is not the same type of coffee that we have now. It was a different type of drying process, so it doesn't taste quite the same. But still, now they have dried coffee versus like in the Civil War, they were actually taking coffee and grinding it and making coffee, you know, on the road. Now they've got instant coffee and they're just putting that in the can. By World War II, they switch up the use of the can with the C rations, and the K rations sort of became that grazing mentality. And so depending on if it was your snack ration, these are your field rations. So it's either your snack ration, which could have biscuits, jerky, cigarettes, instant coffee, or your breakfast one, which could have, again, would have usually cigarettes, instant coffee. You might like this because it's the breakfast one. I heard of guys, they called them poop bars. They were fig bars, which in my mind are like Fig Newtons, but I guess not nearly as good because they call them poop bars.
Well, and it's actually, it's fruited cake, just fruited for the record.
Cake. Fruited cake. Sorry. Of course. Oh, I'm so sorry. I'm sorry. The fruited cake bars, yes, exactly. the fruited poop bars of World War II.
Exactly.
Which they didn't like to the point that when one of my veterans told me that after the liberation of Paris, they went back into Paris and kids were begging for, they'd be like, cigarette, papa, cigarette. And they would give them the poop bars instead, you know, which was still, I guess, a treat, but that's how willing they were to give away the poop bars. And then powdered eggs, which you mentioned eggs. Yeah, powdered eggs were by number one out of every complaint that I've heard from World War II veterans were number one and evidently are still number one. I've heard and read about people today complaining about the omelets in MREs today. Powdered eggs are still pretty horrible. But the K rations were sort of would lend to our civilian snacking habits too because they were biscuits, jerky, you know, sometimes chocolate, which has changed over time. Sometimes they've had good chocolate. They've had, you know, M&Ms or chocolate that tastes like chocolate. Sometimes it's not great. They have the D-bar, which was intentionally created not to taste good. It was fortified with oats. The sugar was sort of rebalanced. It's bitter chocolate, milk powder, oat flour, and some vitamins added to it so that it intentionally is not something they'd want to eat, but that at 600 calories a square, you'd get three of them together. So you'd have enough calories in an emergency. So those could be in them too. So they changed as World War II went on, but they were, they were sort of the snack pack version of the rations versus the C rations, which were the first real meal in a can.
So first off, I love that you mentioned the powdered egg part because I've had some interactions with World War II veterans, and it's weird that they all mention the same specific thing.
I know, right?
Yeah, that was a big swing and a miss. We know now that this evolution, C ration, K ration, all the way through various different conflicts around the world and various different missions, we know they ultimately led to what armies eat today. Here in the United States, we call this the MRE, the meal ready to eat. I believe the first MREs came out pretty recently in the span of history, right? In the 1980s or so?
Yeah, that's when we officially changed the name and put them in this sort of new packaging. Because up until the late 70s, we didn't really have the pouch technology that we have now. So from World War II forward, we had cans and then we had dehydrated foods. And that was sort of what we had up until now. So the powdered foods in World War II, it wasn't only powdered eggs. Talk about menus. I love looking at these old menus you can find. And potatoes were another thing that were powdered in World War II. They were called flaked potatoes if they were trying to make them fancy. they would use these rehydrated potato flakes. Milk was powdered. Cheese could be powdered. Most of the time, those were used more in the garrison camps to feed people, not necessarily in the field. But they basically tried to just to save space, right? Because again, you're moving in World War II. We had over 16 million people working in World War II, which is why we have all of this innovation that came out of World War II. But to save space, you dehydrate things. That's the fastest and easiest way to shrink something down. So they dehydrate milk, they dehydrate eggs, they dehydrate potatoes, and then reconstitute them. In regular just dehydration, you just pull the water molecules out. Some things in the foodstuffs are going to oxidize. They're going to deteriorate. You're going to lose some flavor. You're going to lose some aroma when you rehydrate them. And so those things like the instant coffee weren't going to smell as good. The powdered eggs, you're never going to get the texture of powdered eggs or fluffy, fatty mashed potatoes. And so what they figured out later was freeze dehydrating under pressurized conditions, which is what we use now, which is completely different. So you bring the materials to below the freezing point. You shock those molecules into immobilization. So the water is still going to freeze and sort of separate, but everything else stays intact, or as much as possible stays intact. So fat molecules, sugar molecules, they're not sort of breaking down. And then with, you know, immense pressure, then you vacuum out the frozen water. And so everything's okay comparatively. So that form of dehydration just really changed how we have dehydrated foods. And led to what the Army wanted to sort of do with MREs in the future, or with what would become the MREs of the future, with just dehydrating foods. Like, we all, you know, grew up with having astronaut ice cream, you know, for fun as kids. Mm-hmm. And that essentially is what they thought that they could actually do for military food, like with both sweet and savory foods, just freeze dehydrating food. And I have not heard this yet because I have not started interviewing Vietnam veterans, but I've been told that I might be hearing some freeze dehydrated foods dropped into those veterans because, again, they are incredibly light and they can be, you know, packed, you know, immense amounts of food can be sent in into very remote locations. But then you have the problem of A, reconstituted, you know, think about like reconstituting freeze dried ice cream. It's not going to have the texture of ice cream at all. And then on top of that, you know, you've got petrified water conditions. And then imagine doing that like with roast beef or something. It's just not going to be a satisfying food. So that was a huge failure in that way. But that does give us the better coffee, the better cocoa. Now in MREs, we have, you know, mochaccino versus just instant coffee. And that comes from a better way of powdering coffee and powdering different types of fat.
Or like a, you know, like a nice Sanka. You like a Sanka?
Sanka. Yeah, Sanka was, that was another step too. You know, we had instant coffee and then had Sanka.
I still don't really know what it is. I don't understand what Sanka is.
Neither do I, but they make it look really cool on television, right? I'll have a Sanka.
You made a really good point. We had a little computer glitch and we're offline for a second. We were just chatting about how like so much of the prepackaged food we eat today, it follows a lot of these same rules, but it's just like a better kind of bougier version of these MREs. I wonder if we could maybe take things to the present and talk about how MREs have kind of improved. And maybe while they're still not as good as like, you know, our kid cuisines or whatever, they're a hell of a lot better than they used to be in the early days.
Yeah, there's two things I sort of geek out about for this that are not really sexy, but the biggest thing is, to me, is the container. Again, the container itself is this retort pouch, which are it's the same plastic pouches that now, you know, give us Go-Gurt and are those little squeeze tubes that, you know, we have peas in and stuff like that. And again, they seem pretty innocent, but these things are amazing because they are different layers of material that allow us to cook food inside of them at slightly higher temperatures than you need to in a can, but because there's a greater surface area for a shorter amount of time. And so the food just is going to taste fresher. You're going to have less of a breakdown of the actual food. So if you put chunks of beef in there, they're going to actually be chunks of beef or beans, like the MREs that I have just to have them are black beans, you know, so you're going to have the texture of beans, not like bean mush. And then you can heat them up faster as well in the field. So you don't need to, it's not a can that you're heating up to eat, you know, the corned beef and potatoes that our World War II veterans were eating. Now you can have a much wider variety of foods, pastas and things like that, that are going to have a better mouthfeel. You can heat them up faster. So it's this whole new world because of these specifically made plastic pouches, which plastic was, we can complain about it a lot now, but starting in the 50s, the military invested in this finding, you know, in developing with all these private companies, developing plastic and what we could do with it. So making a seal that you could essentially vacuum seal these pouches, you could pressure cook them, and then they do well in extreme conditions, in heat, in pressure, in humid climates, dry climates. They can hold up better than cans did. So that, I think, is particularly exciting that these pouches sort of really changed the game when it comes to how our MREs taste today.
Mm-hmm. And we also know that there is a lot of research that goes into this. The food science here is fascinating because despite what many people in the military may believe, the researchers do actually run extensive taste tests and extended, you know, feeding tests both in the field and in the lab, which I feel like sounds like a cool lab rat job, you know, because it's not all going to be the infamously terrible veggie omelet of 2007 or what's that other really creepy Captain Chicken. Did you ever hear that one, Noel?
It's still around. We've got a full list here from How Stuff Works. We've got stuff like beefsteak with mushrooms and Western beans. I'm more of a Northern beans kind of guy myself. We've got this very odd combination of pork rib and clam chowder. Who asked for that?
Oh, goodness.
I don't understand. We've got beef ravioli and potato sticks. Sure. Country Captain Chicken, which isn't inherently bad, Ben. I mean,
oh, it's like famously bad.
This one is famously bad as an MRE, but I just mean the dish is, it's like an Indian thing, I think.
I believe you're correct, yeah.
And buttered noodles. Then we have chicken breast and minestrone stew, chicken with Thai sauce, just generic Thai sauce. Sure. They don't give us any more than that.
Well, you get some rice with it.
Well, it's yellow / wild rice pilaf. That's a lot of rice combos. You want to give us some more,
Ben?
Well,
there are 24 in all. So
some favorites.
Yeah, you can see the full list. And, you know, they want to have this variety. So for every meatloaf with gravy, you might get a chicken tetrazzini or so on. And what we see is that the food science has also verged into psychology. They found that varying the menu means that people will eat more because there's a lot of variety. So you're not getting, you know, Country Captain Chicken or even manicotti every day. And this is something that was interesting to me. They found that if they gave things commercial or civilian graphics, people tended to like them more. So that's why hot sauce is a huge commodity in MREs today. And that's why, you know, you'll get side items like candies and stuff that'll have a brand name because, I don't know, maybe it reminds people of home. Maybe there's familiarity.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you don't feel like you're eating out of a drab olive bag.
Right. Like you said, I think you mentioned this. They even have kind of sexed up the packaging a little bit where it might have like a cool logo or more of like a snazzy graphic design kind of concept to it, which, you know, I'm a big fan of brightly colored sodas. Don't know why. Doesn't matter what they taste like. I also like things that are green. Like I like pistachio ice cream. I like the flavor, but I also love the fact that it's green.
Or like blue Powerade.
Yeah. Or one of my personal favorites, Superman ice cream, which is really just vanilla ice cream, but it's just like multicolored.
And that makes me, I don't know.
I'm just really into it for some reason.
Freaks me out, man.
I'm a real sheep.
No. What is life if not to be lived? We also know that MREs, in addition to inspiring so much civilian food, they're also used in civilian emergency situations like natural disasters.
Right.
So we can get a lot of food to people very quickly. But MREs are not the only example of modern military food. There are tons of other militaries in the world, right? And they often have their own kind of thing. I read somewhere that for a number of years, the French version of the MRE, the RCIR, was considered the best. And people would, you know, different soldiers from different militaries would meet and they would kind of trade these back and forth. And even now, if you have listened to this and you are interested in trying an MRE, you can find them online. I think you can pick them up from Amazon even, or of course, eBay. But buyer beware because, you know, they may not be as recent as you would like. Learn from my mistakes, folks. Don't get stuck with that 2007 veggie omelet, which I just want to point out, apparently the street name for that thing, you guys, is the vomlet. Yeah.
What is in the breakfast one that you have, Ben, currently?
It's the veggie omelet.
That's one. It? You yeah. have several of them? I thought you had a few.
No, I have one breakfast one, and then I have a, I think a jalapeno chicken dish that I gave to our ride or die pal, Matt Frederick.
Oh, nice.
Stuff they don't want you to know.
Good. For all this coronavirus prepping?
Yeah. Yeah,
is
yeah,
Is that
yeah.
the deal? Okay.
Oh, no, no. I was doing that anyway because I had to build a new bug out bag.
I see.
Coronavirus notwithstanding.
Yeah, no, no. You had a doomsday prepper shelter before it was in vogue.
Thanks,
for
man.
Sure. Quick question, though. What's this omelet situation like? You literally just add water and stir it around and it's basically just like weird egg pudding kind of, or what?
They come with a flameless heater, I believe.
I see.
So, because we also found out people want to eat food hot. And this is where we're at now. We don't know, well, I guess I don't know, and only, I don't think either of us know what the future of MREs is. But Jacqueline, do you think that the technology involved is kind of at a, I don't want to say at a plateau, but at a stable point? Is there anything that people are trying to change with MREs in the future, or have we arrived at the perfect army food?
Well, I think right now what they are seeking, they've sort of hit as far as making these rations for men and women who are functioning at a very high energy level. They are packed with sodium, they're packed with carbohydrates, they're packed with calories, they're jacking them with caffeine, with vitamins. I think that's sort of where they're continuing to try to excel, is figuring out how to get all this stuff in the foods and actually making them still palatable and taste good. There are a lot of jokes about MREs. You mentioned the vomlet. They're called meals ready to exit. There's a lot of jokes about how bad they are because they're so high in sodium. You know, they're really not great for the body after a couple of days, or the digestion, literally, but they technically have all the nutrients that people want in them. I'm particularly curious about getting fresher foods and vegetables into them, because that's still going to be the biggest problem, is how you get something other than, you know, Zapple sauce, which has a lot of sugar and carbs and sometimes caffeine in it. But the difference between MREs for civilians and soldiers is that they are burning their bodies, you know, and that's really what these foods are intended to do. So I think it's continuing to figure out how to make them durable, portable, you know, consistent, and so that people will want to eat them. And we have a very multi-ethnic, multicultural military. And I think that's the awesome thing about the variety of MREs we have now versus when we were in Vietnam, versus the Korean War, World War II. So that to me is the exciting thing to see continue to develop, just how, you know, being American soldiers, how that is just encompassed in this menu. So who knows where that is, how that's going to continue and keep going.
Why do you think there isn't more like vacuum seal technology being used? I wonder if that would be an alternative or a way to have like fresher foods that could last a little longer.
That might just be Americans resisting that. I believe that is already much more commonly used for both militaries and civilians in Asia and in Europe. I forget exactly where, but I believe that we've just been slower to acquire that. I think that might be happening more and more, but I think we've just been slower to acquire, even just foods in pouches has been slower on our end than it has been in other countries.
My last question, and then I will throw it to my co-host to ask any final wrap-up questions. Did you guys ever have those milks that came in a bag when you were in school?
Yeah, it's weird.
Milk in a bag?
Milk in a bag.
Yeah, it's like the same. It's the same amount of milk as you would get in the typical paper carton,
right,
that lunch kids get, but it's in this weird bag that looks like some kind of
like a breast implant or something.
Yeah, yeah. I was trying to think of a different way to say it. Looks like an implant.
I'm intrigued.
You get a little straw.
You stab it in there.
You have to stab it.
Yeah.
Which made it a hot commodity.
It seemed like a bit of a flash in the pan, because I only remember it for like 1 year in elementary school, mm-hmm, and then it was back to cartons. I wonder what the thinking was behind that. Huh. Easier to ship, maybe? You could just plop them all into a box and didn't have to stack them?
It's stayed around in other places.
Yeah. You might be right, yeah.
milk in a bag aside, I do also want to point out that you can buy MREs from all over the world online. I'm particularly excited about this Korean, apparently bulgogi-flavored rice I've got on the way. Yeah, and I'm going to check out the technology there. But while we're waiting for that, we want to say, Jacqueline, thank you so much for joining us today and giving us this strange and fascinating journey through the history of food and the history of militaries. For anyone who would like to learn more about service, veteran stories of hunger and war, where should they go? Where can they find the show?
Well, you can find us streaming on all podcasting platforms, of course, iHeartRadio, Apple, etc. And you can learn more at servicepodcast.org. And we are also always sharing a lot of extra nerdy food history and outtakes from our veterans on Facebook and Instagram. We are at Service Podcast.
And you, by this point, by the time this episode comes out, you will have wrapped your first season? Is
that
right?
Yeah, we just wrapped our first season. So we featured a number of World War II veterans themselves and then also some historians to help us sort of recap how World War II changed the world.
Yeah, and not only is it a really fascinating podcast where you learn a lot, it's really well produced and very moving, great storytelling. Really props for a wonderful show, and congratulations on wrapping the first season.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, and don't take our word for it, folks. Don't delay. Check out the first season, available in its entirety today. Thanks, as always, to our super producer, Casey Pegram. Thanks to Alex Williams, who composed our banging soundtrack.
Thanks to Christopher Hasiotis, who, as it turns out, is also the executive producer of this delightful show, Service. He is here in spirit, as always. He is like Mufasa, just like a lording over all of us, like a giant, stately lion in the sky. Thanks to, we already said super producer Casey Pegram. I'm going to give him, he's so nice, you thank him twice. Thanks to Gabe Luzzi, our incredible research associate. I think it turns out he's not a bot. He is an actual human person, and he's going to be on the show at some point soon. So you're going to hear the true voice of Gabe. You heard it here first, folks.
He is the chicken tetrazzini of our show.
We'll see you next time, folks. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.